my job today is tell you how I incorporated that data quality chapter of the Miro into our now new practices. So just to give you a quick objectives, I'm going to describe briefly that data quality chapter a little bit in detail, some of the principles and recommendations, demonstrate how we use that best practice guide and use it as a gap analysis to see kind of where are our holes in our activity and what can we improve on. And then I'm going to show you this new report that we're in development and still trying to get rolled out soon. But as I'm here at the conference, I keep finding new things to add to it, so hopefully we're going to close it out soon. Just so for those of you that haven't seen this chapter, the image on the left is actually the front page of that document. It is 100 pages, so if you're not really wanting to do that, ERA and the Miro committee came up with a mini guide, and those were available at the ERA booth, but if you can't get a hold of those, down at the bottom is that website, you can get those. But the mini guide is just more or less a summary of that chapter, so again, if you guys don't have time to read the full thing, it summarizes it for you, but I still encourage you to read the 100 pages. It's actually well worth it. So just real quickly, the chapter itself is broken up into three major sections. There's a principles section, which the definitions there, principle gives you a high level direction that reflects business guidelines, practices, and the norms that help guide the development of more specific business rules. There was 13 developed in this chapter. There's business rules. I say 32 with 43 parts. What that means is there was actually 32 rules, but when we developed an assessment tool to go along with this, we actually had to break it out a little bit, some of those, because one applied more to direct entry and then one to interface ones. So you may have fully met one of them, but not the other. And then the pre-certification and provider's profile is more or less the process of for evaluating the incoming data prior to getting them live or submitting that data live. And there was 12 of those. So I don't know if you can really see those. This is the actual assessment tool that we made or we created to go along with the chapter. So any of you guys IIS could take this and say, okay, here are the principles. Do I fully meet them? Do I follow them? Do I not follow them? And maybe why? What were your barriers? And then you can summarize that at the end to say, okay, I'm making 100%. I don't have to worry about this section. I'm good. But for me, we didn't have it all. So just to, if you can't read some of those, the principle one is consistency principle. The conditions criteria for validating data elements should be the same regardless of how these data items have been reported to an IIS. And another example is P13, supremacy of medical records principle. Medical records are more reliable source of data than billing data. And then here's some business rules. There again, on this one, the BR101, it's broken out into two sections for the batch or the interface data, and then the UI is the actually direct entry in my mind. And there's 32 business rules of these. And it breaks it out. Do you fully meet them? Do you partially meet them? Do you not meet them? No plan to meet them? And then the pre-certification and provider profile section, there was, I can't remember, it was 13. 11 of these. And just an example is every data submitter is going through a pre-certification process before allowed to submit data to IIS. And just going through this last year, I really highly recommend that. So I agree with the document. in a lot of ways, actually. Here, more or less, how did we rate? We did this assessment tool, and of the principles, there was 8 out of the 11 that we followed currently. Some of the not met ones are listed there, P01, P05, P06. The main barriers that we found, again, were more or less the differences, the way we treated our interface. We've learned it is a lot harder to standardize the EMR systems to set up in their system versus our own IIS, so mandating what they need to do and how they need to report is sometimes variable. Here's the business rules, and again, I created it as a grid just because there's so many breakdowns, whether it's a priority group A, B, C, and then if we fully met them, partially met them, or so on. So you can just see how we kind of rated. The business rules, some of the partially met ones is vaccination should appear in the registry within 2 business days of the report session date. And then the not met, route and site should be consistent with the vaccine type. Again, some of the not met ones, the difference is I can make that a required piece in our IIS, but I can't really do that in an EMR. So we have to kind of take in the data and then deal with it afterwards. And then the pre-certification process, or providers' profiles, we fully met 7 of those 12. partially met. During the pre-certification, source data is compared with medical charts to validate content. We do this to a point, but I think in the future, I'd really like to see a full site visit where we take their medical records and compare in their system to ours if we're actually getting the data across. That would identify if we're not getting codes coming or some miscoding issue possibly. And again, some of these are just like the not met one. IIS maintains profiles for each provider practice that reflects age and type of population served and expected administration of a certain range. We're hoping to do this in the future. It's not incorporated in the report I'm going to show you, but we're going to try to do like a coverage statistics report also to kind of meet that objective or that recommendation. So the outcome, more or less what we found in Kansas, is we developed a new data quality report. This is outside of deduplication at the patient and vaccine level. This is more on completeness, timeliness, and accuracy. For this chapter, we added HL7 status as well because it was a necessity for our IIS. So when I talk about completeness, what I'm looking at is all core data elements that were used, more or less last name, first name, date of birth. What percentage are they sending to us or filling in, like race, ethnicity? That'll tell me if they're not giving me the data, I can't give you a report back out on the data if it's insufficient. Likewise, we've done timeliness, so we can tell, reflects the time difference from the date of vaccination to the date of submission or entered into the registry. And when I cover that part, we found a lot of unique things. Accuracy measures that help indicate if things look accurate based on the ASAP schedules. There's different measures for accuracy. Again, kind of like that thing, reviewing their charts versus what's in the registry. Is it accurate on what's happening in the practice? The way we use this is, again, on those vaccinations administered, was it according to the ASAP guidelines? And then our HL7 status is, it gives us a quick report. We're going to run this monthly. How often these HL7 providers are sending us queries, updates, and then we put some business rules to it. So if we see more queries and updates, we're going to have a chat with that provider. So when I break down completeness, we actually have two sections. One is on patient and one is on vaccinations. So as you see here in this report, we have first name, last name, date of birth, some of the major core data elements, but we've also added a couple more at the bottom. We've got race, ethnicity, but then there's also history of varicella disease. Something that we've just added this last year is a field for actual date of varicella disease. So you'll see that percentage is quite low, and we hope over time that'll increase. And then we've also, at the very last line, it says active patients created by vital statistics. That actually tells us how many records were in the system before this provider added to it. So if they're telling us, you know, there's just not enough time for this data entry, well, heck, 30% of their records are already created for them. So I kind of back off on that. The way these columns are broken out, you see total and percentage of total active patients in the first two. At the very beginning, before we run this, we tell the system the go-live date of this provider, and then if there's a legacy data load, we actually make sure that date is before the go-live, so you'll see a differentiation between the total and then that third column, which is total active since go-live. It means there was a legacy load, which that may not change, but here, since they're go-live, they've seen these many patients, and that's what they're responsible for. So if they're a direct entry provider, you can tell the percentage of data fields that they're actually entering. And if we do trends over time, if this lowers in certain fields, then we know maybe there was a difference in a new person came on and they're not doing the fields right, stuff like that. So we can kind of look at that as process improvement for that clinic. The vaccination completeness, the more and more I look at this, it doesn't really tell me great things just because I can tell on the historical, I know people will just quickly enter it as the vaccine date and type. That's fine. All the other stuff is not required for historical. We'll take it. But generally, they don't do that for time needs. But on the right, those two columns, it's saying administered vaccine. So if you're a direct entry provider, I know that should be 100% because it's required. But we're going to see differences in the HL7 probably. And then those top two columns, that top row where it says total vaccination, for this clinic, it's saying 83% of their records that they've given us vaccines-wise is majority of it's historical, which is fine. But if we see that start decreasing over time, it might be they're not giving us vaccination history anymore. And again, it could be a time for a little chat. The second major section that we cover is timeliness. The reason I've broken it out into two different screenshots here is what we're finding with this timeliness is there is a major difference between the type of provider. So over time, we're going to kind of do some studies to see, okay, is this very characteristic of a private provider versus local health department? As you can see, private providers actually take a little bit more time to enter the data than our public health departments. So those public health departments might have more requirements or restrictions to get it in so they can do those counts. And again, here we have it broken down between historical and administered. And the administered, typically, we would hope for it to be a higher percentage within the one day of administration, which the public health department is showing. But this top one, we also have different two processes how a direct entry can enter that data, whether they're waiting till after the patient's gone and doing the data entry afterwards, or if they're doing it real time as that patient's there. And you can tell here that they're waiting a couple days to enter it, which we don't like to see, but it is a process. And now within the accuracy, we actually had to break it up into two sections as well. In this first section, you'll see there's single vaccination events. So if a child has a DTaP before 6 weeks of age, I want to know about it. And then you have the columns broken up. There's historical, but there's administered. So this historical is saying, okay, this clinic may not have been responsible for administering this, but they still might want to check it to see if that is still a valid dose or not. And then on the two right columns, I would typically want to see this all zeros, but something's going on. Maybe something was administered off-label, and we need to check it out to make sure that patient's covered correctly. What we found down here on the fourth from the bottom is the rotavirus, the first dose of rotavirus after 12 weeks. Typically, we've looked at providers across the board, and this is really high. So we're going to look into that a little bit more and say, okay, maybe our query isn't right, or is this consistently happening and what's going on? And then the second section of the accuracy is when we actually had to do multiple vaccine events. We couldn't run this on that same query as before because it just wasn't quite right. And I think where it says vaccinations up there on the two-column headings, it's actually patients. So how many number of patients had more than two DTaP vaccinations before 4 months of age? So that's actually the number of patients. And again, we wouldn't want this to be high, but because this is looking at a whole record, they might not have been that provider that actually administered all those. So we still want to check into those patients to see what's going on. Why were they over? And again, we did the 10, 20, 30 vaccines before certain age ranges. Why are they getting so much? And probably what we need to incorporate also, like Jody did, is take some of those vaccines like influenza, RSV, and probably BCG off. And then our last section was HL7, only if they're HL7 providers. The reason we did this was we wanted to use this as a comparison for the data quality is, okay, maybe this justifies why we're getting poor numbers on their data quality. And it was a quick way for our HL7 person to quickly say, okay, why are they having more queries than more than updates? What we found, this one vendor, it's automatic. They query on every patient they see, even if they're not immunization. And then the updates wouldn't match that. So those are just some business rules, kind of like on the bottom there. We kind of say, okay, if this is over this, we want to check into it. What's the reasoning here? Or if they're doing majority of queries and not updating it, that might be an indication that they're not actually sending us data, which again, we want to check into that. So in summary, using common consensus best practice approaches to data quality assurance or any of the chapters can provide the basis for system and practice evaluation and improvement. What Kansas did, we developed a new report. We're going to have a secondary report that goes along with this. For all those numbers that had more than a zero, we'll be able to identify that patient that actually was marked for that, and we can investigate further. So IIS staff will review these regularly to make sure there are no high offenders and data quality mishaps. We actually are going to be hiring a new data quality person that will be working on dedupes, but also reviewing this every month. So if somebody's outside the norm, they're going to either notify our IIS staff for some more training or even contact the VFC staff or AFIX on maybe some educational needs. And then that's what the VFC staff will do is once they get these notifications that somebody's outside the norm, they'll possibly set up some visits for educational needs. and then overall the provider quantifiable measures for program evaluation improvement hopefully will increase. And that's my talk. If you have questions, there you go.
Great, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for taking the time to put their talks together and present them to us today. Before we open it up for questions, I'd like to also make a specific call out to someone who's made a lot of significant contributions to this effort, Dr. David Lyland in the front down there. He's been very instrumental in pulling all this together, so I'd like to call out for David to thank you for your help. His passion and dedication for all of this is remarkable, as well as his clear, logical thinking when we're in the midst of something that doesn't seem to make any sense whatsoever. He has a remarkable talent for getting it situated back on the right track. So thank you again, David. Anyhow, certainly we have some great experts up here. We'd love to open the floor up to questions. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes here, so please come on up to the mic. Say your name, where you're from.
Kent from Ohio. Just a quick question about data quality. We did a comparison of data where people were putting, sites were putting data directly in 2007 versus their EMR shift in 2008. And it dealt with lot numbers. They had 200 unique lot numbers, but 1,200 different unique combinations between what that lot number was and the product it was assigned to when it was coming from their EMR. So is there a way, and this is maybe more of a question for CDC since they are working with VIMDIF, et cetera, not to publish which lot numbers people got, but to at least from the McKesson group, identify the lot numbers and the products that are at least distributed through the VFC program or nationally. So that way EMR companies, et cetera, might be able to have to verify or validate that their data is legit, because the lot number combinations, and this is one of the top three EMRs in the country, and they're sending me junk when it comes to lot numbers.
That's a great compliment. Comment. I think we'll have to take that back to the VIMBIP crowd about trying to see how to get that specific thing addressed into the publication of those lot numbers. I think generally that the accuracy and documentation and communication of lot numbers is a huge problem, VIMBIP specific or not. It's broader than just that, and there are some initiatives out there to try and fix that by, movement with AAP to try and see what we can do about putting a new type of barcode on the vaccine vials that can, have it scannable a little faster to get it into EMR systems and then sucked out into IISs from there. So I think it's broader than just the VIMBIP initiative. It's a huge challenge for, any vaccine vial tracking issue and how to grab those electronic medical records. I can't speak to whether or not they can release those lot numbers or so forth, but I think, it's something we can certainly explore with that group and see how that works and so forth. So, please.
I'm Jamie Blake, and I'm from the Michigan Care Improvement Registry. Can I take a shot at answering that?
You can do that too, sure.
Well, in Michigan, we're doing the VIMBIP right now. And, we make them select an NDC code that goes with their lot number and manufacturer, and they all have to be matchy-matchy. They can't type them in. They have to select the NDC code from the list, and then we ask that the EMR, the ones that transfer from the EMR, don't allow any typing in at all, that they load, and it's hard for the providers, but we work with them and their IT people to change their EMR to take out all of the typing in part. Did I not get your question right?
No, it makes perfect sense to recommend that the EMR you pick with
validated list of what's legitimate out there.
Yes.
But as the recipient of incoming data, I'm not in a position to dictate to these hospitals the change orders and costs and everything else they want to piggyback to the healthcare provider in order to implement data quality.
Oh, yeah. It's tough.
It's tough. It's tough.
I apologize for my hair. I went to the thing and it ran over.
Other questions?
Hi, I'm Bridget from Vermont, and I don't scare easily, but one thing that just makes my hair stand on end is bad merge. So I have a question for Jody.
Of course you do.
Well, have you looked closer at those bad merges to find out how they were coming about? And what I'm thinking of is, were you seeing whether they were coming from data entry, HL7, batch load, or whether you were finding like one source that was having errors? Is it a weighting issue? What was causing your bad merges?
I believe, and I don't know if Danielle's in the audience or not, but our process has an automatic deduplication patient section, and it is weighted to an extent, I believe. And so it does look at a few things that are too similar, and when we separate them, the kid, if you didn't really look closely at the record, you would say they were the same kid. But it's like a guardian name is different, and that can happen with mom or dad bringing them in and an address being changed. But the names are spot on, the dates of birth are spot on, and it's just they look too similar for the system not to say that they're not the same. So we do have a manual deduplication for any of those that it can't 100% say that the kid is the same. And so there could be some human error in the bad merge process, but this hopefully will capture some of those before the providers start yelling at us. But it's a weighted system. And in our current system, the ability to see how that merge happened has been taken away, but in an upgrade, it'll come back. So I'll be able to look at it more thoroughly in future reports. Thanks, Bridget.
Hi, I'm Anna from Houston. I was wondering if any of you had dealt with the issue of twins. I know in Houston we had extensive problems with Jamil and Jamail.
Yeah.
Same last name, same date of birth, same guardian, same everything.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
In our product, which is made by STC, they have the ability of birth field and birth order. So they can say that this is one of two for twins and two of two of twins. And we had problems. We would separate those twins, and then, 3 months later, when a new record came in, they'd merge back together, and we're like, what is going on? Not everybody was sending in the birth order, birth field. And so now in our system, that section is promoted to each reserve that comes in, regardless of if they've entered it or not. So those twins now stay separate. So that's how our vendor has kind of gone through and helped us keep those twins apart, because that was a major problem. And then triplets also, we were having the same thing with triplets. So we have one family in our system, every boy in their family born over a 10-year span of time has the same name, and they're a suffix 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So they also merge all the time together. That one's harder because they're not twins or triplets.
Great. I have a quick question for Nicole and Jody. I was wondering, in your pre-certification phases or your call-up phases, when you would call a provider to clarify something, I know you've threatened that several times. I'm wondering how how receptive the providers are to get that kind of feedback, either when they start, when you're in the pre-certification phase, and then how they are about, oh, yeah, I screwed up, I'll fix it, or whatever. How is that kind of reaction going?
It depends on the provider, actually. For the pre-certification part, it's actually required on some of the things that they have to clean up before we take them live. So they kind of know it's either break or it takes them to break them or not. So they're pretty willing to clean it up. Some take quite a while. We've worked with one provider 8 months. They're just, one clerk is really slow. She just doesn't want to do it. And then there's some that are just love it, want to be on it, and just do it the next day. So right. That depends. As far as the other sections, I think it's going to be a good tool, because a lot of our providers are really wanting to see how, you know, the data, because they want to clean up the data, especially the accuracy section. They want to know that they're doing something wrong, because the vaccine schedule is so complex. Half the time they don't know they're doing something wrong.
Right.
So I think it's going to be a good thing.
So that feedback is positive?
Yeah.
Yeah, we also have a positive rapport with our, we have two trainers in our system, and they have really good rapports with their providers, and they don't really have too much of a problem with them cleaning up what they're sending us. It's whether or not the EMR product will allow them to make the changes without having a price tag on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
they haven't deleted their numbers out of their speed dial or whatever when they see your name calling. Okay, that's good. Any other questions? Well, great. Thanks to our speakers for coming today. So.